At the UPS store, we know being a small business owner means holiday time is still go time. Still get those orders shipped time. And still re-up on stamps and supplies time. That's why this upcoming holiday, while others close up shop, we'll be open. And happy to help you keep being unstoppable. Come into your local store today. Most locations are independently owned. Product services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS store. Be unstoppable.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month. No commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Lithium ion batteries power almost everything around us. Your phone, your laptop, your electric cars that glide silently through cities, and even the medical devices that are quietly keeping you alive. Increasingly, the systems run off of artificial intelligence itself. They're so familiar, we barely notice them, which is exactly why they're so powerful. Because the battery-powered world that we live in rests on supply chains that we never see. One that stretches across continents, across political systems, and across the lives lived very far from where our technology is designed and consumed. Today's episode is about the batteries that become more than technology. They become a new kind of power. Power measured not just in energy density, but money, geopolitics, surveillance, labor, and control. Power that concentrates in some places and extracts itself violently from others. This is a story that runs on cutting-edge laboratories, two open pits in the southern Congo. And the reality of it is that it's more than just the electric vehicles that we use. And it promises more than just sustainability. It also tells us a lot more about the uncomfortable reality of who pays for it. I'm your host, Autumn Phaneuf, and joining me on Breaking Math is Nicholas Nerakos, discussing his new book, Elements of Power. Today, we're asking a simple but unsettling question. What does it really cost to power the future? And who gets to decide? Now, tell me a little bit about your background and what inspired the book.
Yeah, so I've been a journalist most of my professional life, basically all of my professional life. I started as a fact checker, and then I left fact checking. And I was very, very keen on reporting on stories that had to do with corruption. One of the things that I had done while I was at The New Yorker was report where I could during holidays and time around work and so on the migration and refugee issues surrounding people coming to Europe. And that had really started in Greece. And my family is from Greece. I'm from Greece. And so I saw the beginning of that in the islands in the east of Greece, in Lesbos, in Samos, and so on. And then I started going deeper into issues that were actually affecting the countries that the people were coming from. So I started looking at conflicts, I started looking at economic issues, and I went down a rabbit hole on Congolese corruption. And I found out that the country has some of the minerals that are super important for building batteries, cell phones, electric cars, and it's one of the wealthiest countries in the world in terms of underground resources, and yet it is still one of the poorest places in the world. So I think that was what brought me to Congo. There was a specific story of corruption around a man named Dan Gertler, who was sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department in 2017. And he was a kind of, his story was something that I wanted to go and write about. And then I went down there, I realized it was so much bigger than this one story. And I guess I sort of went on Amazon and I looked and I said, is there a cobalt book? And then you know, in 2018, 2019, there was not. You know, there have been some books that have treated certain aspects of this issue. But what I kept feeling as, you know, as I was writing my book and I saw these other books coming up around it, was actually that this story deserved a greater lens, an expanded worldview, a look at what was happening in China, a look at what was happening in Indonesia, a look at what was happening in the Western Sahara, and not just focusing on one aspect of the supply chain. So, you know, luckily I had a wonderful team at Penguin who were very supportive of that. And that was kind of, you know, we set out to write a global history of this very, very complicated supply chain, I guess.
Now, what kind of power are we actually talking about?
Power here functions both as a, you know, as a very, you know, in a logical way, it's electricity and it's a storage of electricity, but it's also about geopolitical power. It's about who owns the mode of powering society, of getting around, of heating our homes, of being able to communicate, of going on social media, of, you know, so on. And it really just goes, the list is endless. And oil was the definitive story of energy in the 20th century. In the 21st century, there are so many different ways of getting around. There are so many ways of powering your devices. But lithium ion is just the most important at this point. And that's to do with, you know, Tesla making the lithium ion battery the technology to use an electric vehicle. Now, there are some sodium ion battery powered vehicles in China, and you know, that's obviously a development, but most electric vehicles are powered by that. Most of our cell phones are powered by that. Most of our laptops, most of our Ori rings, payments, whatever it is, you know, these wireless headphones that I just got for running because somebody told me I was going to get mown down by a vehicle if I didn't use non-noise cancelling headphones or whatever it is. So yeah, it's they're everywhere. And they're, you know, we see that fire departments are saying that they're causing fires in people's homes. We see that people are able to make smaller and smaller things. I get ads for battery packs on Instagram the whole time. And I think that was very much true for the global north for a long time. And maybe the global south was not so much, you know, that technology had not gone out to the global south. I think that that has definitively changed in the last 10 years, basically. There is a proliferation of these batteries everywhere across the planet. I mean, I guess there are some sort of uncontacted tribes in Peru and Brazil who are not affected by lithium-ion batteries in some way. But if not, everybody's life everywhere is affected by these things.
So essentially, when batteries die, modern life briefly stops, or may actually stop in one way or another.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you start a little bit with a origin story around 1991.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Why does it matter?
So 1991 was the first commercialization of the lithium-ion battery. It had been this sort of essentially a research project up until that point. It had been in the 70s, Dr. Stanley Whittingham, a sort of genius scientist in working for Exxon, put together a lot of kind of hints, essentially, about how, he had worked on fast ion transfer in solids, and he realized that you could create a very, very efficient battery by using lithium, intercalating lithium ions into a positive anode and a negative anode, and sort of moving it across into a negative anode. And then, you know, in the early 1980s, another brilliant scientist, John Goodenough, and his team in Oxford realized that you could use cobalts to create the cathode. And then by the mid-1980s, scientists in Japan were looking at a way of creating powerful batteries for small devices, especially because the existing technology, nickel cadmium, was quite polluting. And the Japanese, after various different chemical spills,
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got.
Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work. With over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you. And most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month. No commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
We're getting more and more worried about pollution and toxic dumping and so on. So the lithium ion battery was seen as a cleaner way of powering things and a much more powerful way of powering these small devices. And 91 was when Sony came to the market and said, you know, this is the device. This is the battery that powers our device. The first device that they used it in was a handheld camcorder, and that was very, very successful right off the bat. And by the mid 90s, lithium ion batteries were being used in lots and lots of small devices around Japan, and the Japanese really stole a march on the rest of the world and understood that this technology was commercializable, useful, and would be big, I guess.
Now, you describe a deep, uneven global bargain. Tell us about that. What was the bargain plainly stated?
So the bargain was stated, is clean energy in one part of the world. And then at the other end, and I don't think it has to be like this, but this is the way that it has developed in the system that we live in. At the other end, you have corruption, you have pollution, and you have intense human suffering as people in a very, very poor country like the Democratic Republic of the Congo scramble to get these minerals and try and sell them to the outside world. Or you have pollution and kicking people off their land, like in parts of Indonesia. Or you have very explicitly colonial arrangements in which people are deprived of rights and liberties and so on. And this is, you know, to some extent, this is in the Western Sahara, I show it, but it's also clear as well that this is happening in other parts of Latin America, Northern Argentina, parts of Chile. And then there's another supplemental story about deep sea mining, which I don't really go into in the book. People have built these huge tubes to suck these nodules, which are rich in critical metals, off the ocean floor. That is seen as just to digress for a second, I had a conversation with a major mining company operator, and he was like, I just don't understand it. I mean, we haven't really worked out how to like properly create and finance mines, and why don't we just work on that ecosystem? Why are we trying to build giant tubes to suck things off the ocean floor? Like, these things exist in mines. So yeah, I mean, I guess the point of my book is like, if you work with local populations, these minerals are there. It's not that this system has to exist. It's not that like we have to pollute places. It's just, unfortunately, due to corruption and human selfishness and geopolitics and fear, this system has arisen. And that's the bargain that you were talking about. Yeah.
Now, I find that to be interesting because it seems that battery supply chains make harm easier to ignore than oil ever did. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not an expert on the oil industry. I mean, I think you
understandable.
Know, I've read you know, Dan Juergen's amazing book, and the oil industry, you know, it caused a bunch of harm in terms of geopolitical issues. But I think, and you know, I guess if you're looking at the kind of there will be blood era, you know, there are a whole series of problems around that. I mean, that was very problematic. But mining is very different because it's a much less complicated proposition. You know, you go down into the mine with a metal bar and you start chipping away at the soil, and, you know, lo and behold, this stuff is under the ground. And it's just a much, you know, the barrier to entry is much lower. So the scope for abuse is lower because it's much more accessible. And you can access this stuff by, you know, sending people with metal bars and no shoes to go and mine it. And you can access it by sending children to mine it and so on. So I think that aspect of the abuse is very clear. And then I think there's a bit of a quirk behind the battery supply chain, which is, I would say, because it's so focused in a country like the DRC, which has had a governance issue and has just a particularly nasty history of colonialism, that has really allowed a system of corruption and of dispossession to take hold, and has allowed certain companies to do things like kick people off their villages in order to build a mine and then give them nothing in return or give them very little.
We take it for granted these resources are infinite, but indeed that they're not. It kind of shifts from not just ethics, but also to geopolitics. And we talk about a little bit about the geography of power. Why can't countries just onshore batteries and solve their own problems?
I mean, I think onshoring is a trend, and it has been successful in some industries. The battery supply chain is very, very, very complicated. You know, you have to mine, you have to refine, then you have to go through various different stages of production, also various different stages of refining. So those different stages, some of which are quite polluting as well, some of those things are quite difficult to do in the US. Same with lithium, although Tesla yesterday, I think, actually announced that it was opening the biggest lithium refinery in the US. I think it's a little bit easier than cobalt. Nickel, the same. Getting a battery metal out of laterite nickel is very, very energy intensive. And the most economic way to do that is using coal power in Indonesia. You can create cleaner plants to do that. And you can invest more and try and use cleaner technology to refine this nickel. But the cost always goes up. I don't think actually it would be a huge increase on the consumers. Supply chain experts that I spoke to were talking about a matter of, you know, $100 or something like that for a new cell phone. You know, it makes a difference, of course, but these are not things that are completely impossible to countenance. So I think, you know, going back to the beginning of the supply chain for these large companies, working with people on the ground and trying to improve conditions both at the mines and to do with, you know, other industries and so on, would actually be, in my mind, preferable to onshoring, because, you know, the global system can work. It's not necessarily that these things moving around the world or whatever it is doesn't work. I mean, it does work in this kind of, as I've shown in the book, in quite a unpleasant way. It's more that you have to figure out how to clean up each step of it. And of course, it would be great to onshore battery production, and if every country could produce its own batteries. But because of quirks of geology and various other and also because of the history of some of these places. So China, for example, has invested over the last 20, 30 years very, very heavily into battery manufacturing. And so you have a situation in which one country is much better equipped to do it than almost anywhere else in the world, apart from Korea to some extent. Does the US want to put in that huge investment? I mean, there are some indications that Apple has to try to do it, but it has been very, very, you know, it's been a flash in the pan compared to what their operations in China look like. So I think that's very interesting.
Now, you talk about China's dominance, and when people hear 70 to 90% of batteries are made in China, what do they misunderstand?
Yeah, I mean, people misunderstand that they're just kind of magically created there almost. I mean, people seem to think that cell phones are kind of God-given device at this point. They don't really think about where they come from. And yeah, I mean, it's a huge amount of work that is done in China. And it's not just that China, you know, took this, or it's not just that they like stole it or something like that, which I think is very much a political way of looking at this. It is that China put in a huge amount of work, blood, sweat, tears, accidents, blowing up batteries and so on, and just stomached that and decided that they were going to be number one in battery manufacturing. And lo and behold, through that intense amount of work and through just the volume of people. I mean, the early batteries, as I talk about in the book, built by BYD, which is now one of the biggest electric car companies in the world, were literally created using something that they called the human chain, which was people folding these things together using their hands. I mean, oftentimes these are quite toxic chemicals as well. I mean, just think about that. There's like 1,000 people sitting in a room, you know, putting these batteries together. So, and now the Chinese factories, it was interesting. I spoke to a scientist at Argonne National Lab in Illinois, and she said, look, the battery factories that I've seen in China are just way beyond technologically anything that I've ever seen here. I mean, it's all completely automated. It's all, you go to these battery companies, these battery fairs, and you see these Chinese companies talking about their factories, and they show you these videos, and it's just extraordinary. So they have developed very quickly out of a system that was pretty rudimentary. So I think that, yeah, beyond just understanding that there's a lot of logistics and so on, it's that there was a lot of work and this idea that you know, the US is going to take back the supply chain and so on. It's like, well, you know, does the US want to put in that amount of effort? Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's still happy to get its batteries from China.
That is a good point, because what if the US and Europe are essentially going to, at some point, wake up? What's going to be the bottleneck, or maybe even the hardest part for us to catch up?
I think infrastructure, factories, workers, skills. You know, there are 180,000 researchers at CATL, which is the big battery firm.
Oh my God.
And, you know, in Germany, there's like, I'm trying to remember the statistics. It's 180,000 at CATL and 18,000 at BYD, but in Germany, there's like 15,000. So it's really huge amount of R&D. There's a huge amount of, you know, there's not really a focus on mining. There's not really a focus on creating on these kind of industrial parts of, I mean, it's not valorized in the same way as it is in China.
Sure.
In the US. I mean, I think that people aim to go, you know, intelligent kids, you know, go to college and they aim to go and work in finance. And finance is a very different thing from, you know, industrial production. Obviously, you know, the US still has a great many industries and many and varied industries. But things like battery production, things that are kind of like prosaic almost, are not as well resourced. And I don't think that there's as much of a brain trust as there used to be. So, yeah. And I think that's to do with the way that the economy has moved in the last, you know, 20 years from being, you know, focusing on these large companies to being more of a sort of services-based, finance-based economy.
Yeah, I agree with you there. A lot of the jobs also aren't there.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they can't find the job or the position that they want. Let's shift this a little bit. You talk a lot about Congo and the moral center. How can a country so rich in minerals remain so poor?
I mean, the simple answer to that is corruption. I don't mean just corruption of people on the ground there. I think it's, well, I guess it's extraction and corruption. So Congo has been knocked around for a very, very long time and has been treated very, very poorly, you know, first by slave traders, then by the Belgians, then by their own dictators after 1960, and recently by various different kind of cowboy adventurer businessmen types who have basically come and tried to exploit the country for its resources and then sort of leave holes in the ground, essentially. And some are better than others. So yeah, I think that corruption and extraction are the two words that should remain in your mind, because it is a country that has powered and has been important for global transport. Look, the rubber that was extracted by King Leopold II from Congo was used to build tires. I mean, it was the biggest rubber exporting country in the world at the beginning of the 19th century. That was concurrent with the automobile and the bicycle boom. So rubber tires came from came from Congo. Then when electricity started being put into everybody's houses, a lot of the world's copper came from Congo. When the atomic bomb was built, the minerals for the first atomic bombs came from the south of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or Belgian Congo at the time, I guess. And then cobalt, then copper, you know, became important Cold War commodities. There's another type of ore in the northeast called coltan, which is used to produce tantalum, and that is used in capacitors in batteries around the world. In capacitors and electronic devices around the world. So it just appears as if every single time something is found in Congo, you have this sort of resource curse. And again, it doesn't need to be like that. I mean, you could extract these minerals from the soil and properly pay people.
Of course.
And Congo, as I point out in the book, has a pretty strong mining code. Legally, the legal system is there, but it's just ignored. And that's the problem, is that so much money is stolen by so many different types of people that very little of it gets down to the man on the street.
So essentially, it almost becomes unavoidable, whether it's in the story or whether it's for our resources.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that corruption is unfortunately a fact of life, and it is very, very closely related to extraction.
Now, you're going to have to help me get through this name. Why did you choose to begin with Odilon Kajumba Kalinga?
So Odilon was a guy that I met out there, quite sort of thoughtful person who kind of understood his own place in the system. And, you know, that was, and was quite good about talking about it. He also sort of let me in to his life, and we had many, many conversations. I interviewed lots of artisanal miners for this story, and I've used various parts of various stories. But Odilon's story, to me, exhibited the arc of a young man who was brought up to expect something from life, and then his dad died tragically, and he had to support his family, so he went to this mine and started digging out metals. But he absolutely hated it, and he was very clear about that. And he said, you know, the reason I'm doing this today is that I don't want my children to be digging out metals from the soil. And but he was also somebody who just had so much bad luck. I mean, he just never could seem to make it work. And that was very, very clear that a lot of people were going through that. I mean, the majority of artisanal miners that who were trying to go through that. A lot of artisanal miners were going through the same thing. And what was interesting about him as well was that he had had the presence of mind to say, I'm going to stop. I don't want to do this anymore. And yet there was nothing for him to do, basically. His dream is to set up a little restaurant and to serve people beer and have a little place where you can have snacks. And he has like quite a good... it's a terrace. He wants to like have an outdoor terrace kind of idea. And he has like quite a good idea of what he wants to do, but he's just not been able to do that. Because the economic situations are such that he hasn't been able to put together the funds to do it. And he just hasn't been able to find any other type of job, which to me was emblematic of this real problem. When you have an economy that is based only on one type of industry, what do you get at the end? And you get a situation in which basically unless you're mining, you're out of work. I mean, unless you're very lucky or have some kind of other means to invest in something else.
Absolutely. I think that's anywhere, especially nowadays. Now, you go into also a lot of the health of families and children and the long-term harm that's caused by mining. Now, beyond mine collapses, what's some of the damage that you see?
So there was a study by The Lancet which showed that there were some of the highest concentrations of metals, of heavy metals, ever recorded in some people living in that region. Obviously, heavy metals are very, very dangerous, especially for pregnant mothers. There's ore that people are washing that's radioactive. you know, children who are fed various stimulants in order to go down the mine and given alcohol to boost their bravery or whatever it is. There are children who are you know, born with deformations because of the toxic minerals that their parents have been exposed to. So there are many, many, many health effects. And I saw that very, I saw that in a very stark way doing the rounds with a doctor who was trying to raise awareness about this, Dr. Billy McCong, who took me on his rounds and we just, you know, person after person with health defects. And he was explaining how he had delivered many children who had swollen heads and various different issues that he attributed to various different types of poisoning.
Okay. Like we usually don't see that as much firsthand here.
Yeah.
So it kind of, it's a bit of a culture shock when transitioning from that state to where we are.
Well, when you also, when it just, it's a very, very like, it's this kind of strangely logical thing. It's like when you have a mine where you're like digging up all these minerals, you produce a lot of dust and that dust blows across the city. And unless you like mitigate that, that dust is, you know, full of heavy metals, which are in some case radioactive, in some case toxic. And even I, being there for a couple of weeks at a time, you know, you would start getting sinusitis, you would start getting issues with your with your nose and your whole sort of like everything would clog up, and everybody there would say, you know, look, this is because you are basically inhaling minerals whenever you go outside.
Now it looks like it's essentially weak oversight on the regulations,
or no oversight.
Yeah. Okay. No oversight in this case. What does that look like being on the ground?
It looks like people without shoes going down into these mines. It looks like soldiers being paid off by miners going, you know, sneaking onto mine sites. It looks like the regulatory standards body being used as a way of extracting rent from artisanal miners by certain ethnic groups. I mean, it's I would say in terms of health and safety, you know, in some places it barely exists. That said, the large industrial mines, you know, if you cross the road outside of, you know, they can drive at sort of 10 miles an hour around these sites, and then if you cross the road outside of the zebra crossing or whatever it is, the crosswalk, you know you're shouted at, you're told, you know, safety is the most important thing here. So I found that the only safety was private safety, private security that was being enforced. The government had kind of very much receded. And the only palliative to that was civil society. And the Congolese civil society is very strong and unfortunately very under-resourced. But the amount of work that they do and the amount of incredible, you know, document gathering and sensibilization and all these things is quite remarkable.
Now, thinking about a little bit more about the history, doesn't go away in any way, shape, or form. Now, I'm curious, how did colonial extraction shape today's mining?
So colonial extraction happened under a monopoly company, which was called Gécamines, which actually started with this like colonial company called the Union Minière, which started as the Compagnie du Katanga, which was started in the very late 19th century as a purely colonial play. And then it became the Union Minière, the mining union of Katanga. Then this is just in Congo. It's funny because in Indonesia, you saw very similar things happening with some of the Dutch companies. Western Sahara, the Spanish phosphate mining company, came the Moroccan phosphate mining company. But in Congo, what happens is that this huge monopoly company suddenly collapses in the 1990s because so much has been stolen from it. And it's gone through this crisis of management. They purged its management. There have been ethnic purges against certain people from a certain ethnic group called the Luba Kasai, because one of the opposition politicians was a Luba Kasai. It gets very complicated. And so that colonial vestige collapse, and yet it's still there. It's not doing anything, but it still has 20% of all these mines. And so they sell these things off, but the sort of shadowy hand of colonialism, even though colonialism reinterpreted through, you know, years of indigenous dictatorship, remains, and it remains to this day. And funnily enough, I think 2 days ago, you saw the first exports of copper to the United States from the Southern Democratic Republic of the Congo. And that was done under the aegis of this company, Gécamines, which has not really extracted copper in 20 years or 30 years. So it's quite interesting. And it was from a Chinese as well.
So if we're looking at science and essentially what comes next, you included some battery scientists like Whittingham in this story. Tell us a little bit about him.
So Stanley Whittingham, brilliant scientist, British, studied tungsten bronzes while he was in Britain, came over, studied at Stanford, and then decided to go to work for Exxon, where he built the lithium-ion battery, the first lithium-ion batteries. And that was really a play by Exxon. Were concerned that oil was running out. There was this kind of fear that the world had hit peak oil in the 1970s. That was obviously that with new discoveries was kind of washed away very quickly. But that was one of the things that Exxon was thinking about, and they thought about how could we build an electric car. And that's essentially what Whittingham ended up doing, even though the batteries that he produced were sort of more like watch batteries.
Now, you just mentioned electric cars. Thinking about the supply chains that we're dealing with right now, what's the biggest misconception about batteries and electric vehicles being automatically green?
So building an electric car is much more environmentally problematic than a gas-powered vehicle or a hybrid. The greenest thing, I ran the numbers on various different cars, a Tesla, BMW, and I think it was a Toyota Prius. And of those cars, the most environmentally friendly one was the Prius. So this idea that electric vehicles are intrinsically greener is just not correct, because you have to look at scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3 emissions. That scope 1 emission is, you know, what directly comes out of the tailpipe. Scope 2 emissions are the production emissions in production, and then scope 3 is kind of like broader emissions that have come from creating this vehicle. And if you look at all of those altogether, it's very, very clear that having an electric vehicle and then selling it in 2.5 years, as the average American does, is the least green thing that you could do. And then buying another one, because producing them is just so much more environmentally costly than producing a gas vehicle.
Okay, that is mind-blowing. That is mind-blowing, because nobody would ever think of that. Now, if batteries are not going away, what is one thing that we can actually do better on?
We can do better by speaking to local communities, going there, trying to improve conditions on the ground, not buying metals from children, basically. Thinking about the approved suppliers in the supply chains that are published. You know, for many years, people said, oh, we've had a green supply chain. And you look and you say, what's this company? Zhejiang Huayu Cobalt. Zhejiang Huayu Cobalt's subsidiary in Congo is called CDM. And CDM has very, very lax, or at least I saw this firsthand. You know, CDM was buying from anybody. So yeah. That on a kind of corporate level. I think on a personal level, I mean, I would say maybe resisting the impulse to buy many lithium-ion batteries. It's actually very difficult because, you know, cell phones die and laptops need to be replaced and so on. So I think the onus is to some extent on the consumer. And then now with the new European battery passports, you know, it's not an infallible system, but, you know, buying things that come from responsible sources, you'll be able to see the sources for your battery, supposedly, by the end of the year or I think beginning of next year. In Europe, there will be more transparency there. And then, you know, I guess writing to congressmen and writing to companies and things like that, and raising this as an issue and showing that you care and bringing it up at board meetings if you're a shareholder or whatever it is. Yeah.
Now, is there anything that you want listeners or viewers to take away from this? What's the big thing?
I think the big idea that I'd like you to take away from this book is that even though we are told over and over again that these things are clean and there are alternatives and that these problems have been solved, they haven't been solved. they need to be addressed and they need to be acted upon. I think that if anything, I hope that, you know, a couple of people will read the book and actually go out there and do the most difficult thing, which is interacting with people on the ground, figuring out how to get the wealth from the resources of countries like Congo back to people on the ground, how to develop programs like agriculture and other industrial programs and so on for the people who are living in these places. You know, that I think is really important. And then I think that, you know, just being more informed about these issues around critical metals and not just thinking this is a zero-sum game, like the US has to have critical metals and the Chinese are like, it's this, it is a battle. It is a battle because we've made it that way, but it doesn't need to be. It doesn't need to be. It can be a much fairer and better thought out system. And yet we seem to be scrambling into the abyss because people are scared. So don't be scared.
Nick, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's tempting to want a clean ending to this story for the technology that we use. That could be a villain, a fix, or a technology that saves us without asking anything uncomfortable in return. But the reality of the world that we live in is that it's not how this story works. Lithium-ion batteries aren't the problem. Climate change itself is real. Electrification matters. Innovation matters. Being ethical about how we source resources is. And none of this is going to go away. So the future may be electric, but it's still being mined. We still deal with politics. And we are still human. And as always, I'm Autumn Phaneuf. And thanks for listening to this episode of Breaking Math. If this episode made you feel uncomfortable, curious, or reflective, good. That's why I always tell you folks to keep questioning and always stay curious about the world that you live in. So I'll see you next time.